The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Well, it is a great day, but you know, for us archaeologists, we're having a great day almost every day on the field. And me and my grandfather, Professor Benjamin Mazar, the late Benjamin Mazar, excavating at the area of the Ophel and the Temple Mount, surrounding the Temple Mount walls for almost 50 years. So this is very special efforts, and we get most interesting finds all the time, because it's a very focused, important area of Jerusalem, of ancient Jerusalem. But now, today, it's a special day in regard of this special find of maybe Isaiah the prophet. This seal impression, which is a little tiny clay with Hebrew letters that says very clearly, Le-Yeshayahu. There is no question about that. It belongs to Yeshayahu, to Isaiah. No. Now, yeah. Is that a prophet, yes or no? We have 3 out of 4 needed letters, because the last letter, the Aleph of Navi, the prophet, was smashed by the person, maybe Isaiah the prophet.
That's Dr. Eilat Mazar speaking with Brad McDonald earlier today in Jerusalem. If you've visited the trumpet.com website this morning, then you know all about the breaking news. Mr. McDonald's piece there has Eilat Mazar discovered archaeological evidence of Isaiah the prophet. There's also a world premiere video there that we've put together. Basically, we had both of these in place. We were waiting on Dr. Mazar's piece to be posted at Biblical Archaeology Review. And so that hit this morning, and then Brad McDonald's piece hit thetrumpet.com, and then the video is there at thetrumpet.com and also at the Key to David City. And, well, we're just putting it out there as far and wide as we can, and we've got a fair bit of promotional work to do here in the next couple of days to get this story out. It's amazing, and we'll spend the second segment of today's show on this subject. But to just give you, or to whet your appetite a bit, it's amazing that this bulla was found just a couple of meters from the Hezekiah bulla, which, of course, gained a lot of international attention a couple of years ago. And then these two together, Isaiah the prophet, I mean, looking at the biblical history, these two, Isaiah the prophet and King Hezekiah, what a relationship they had. So much can be taken from this king-prophet relationship. So many lessons to be learned. As I say, if you haven't visited thetrumpet.com yet today, make this a heavily trafficked day at the website. Because we're going to be getting a lot of people paying attention to this latest sensational discovery. As I say, we'll spend a fair bit more time with this coming up in the second segment. But to begin with here today, just to follow on, really, some points we made yesterday on the program. If you remember, we were talking about the Munich Security Conference, and how that all of these experts were coming away from that conference. Basically, they went away from it concluding that, well, there were some good ideas at the conference, but really no solutions to speak of. No concrete solutions to the many problems in the world today. And a very similar point can be made with all of this arguing going on in the United States over gun control. Lots of people have ideas. Everybody's got an opinion. But what about solutions? What about solutions to these problems, these atrocities, all these murders? Is gun control going to solve the problem? I played a couple of clips yesterday from Herbert Armstrong, on the problems of this world, the paradox. Here we have all of this technological development, and yet these appalling evils that just get worse and worse with each passing year. Here again is what Herbert Armstrong had to say.
And men are trying to live without God, and this world has been built without God. But it has been built, influenced, and guided by Satan the devil. And we're in such a world now. And God is not going to end this world until the world has come to see that it's had 6,000 years and it's tried everything. And as long as man would say, oh, if you'd just given us another few days or weeks or months or maybe years, we would have solved our problems. I tell you, the great of the world think they're still going to solve the problems of the world. They don't admit they're so absolutely that they can't solve the problems. They think we're going to make this a better world some way. We're going to solve all these problems. Well, they've been trying it for the last 6,000 years, and it's getting worse and worse, and they're getting farther and farther away from solutions. Farther and farther away from solutions.
We've tried everything, as he said there, and yet look at how much farther and farther we just get away from the solutions. My father gave a program. This is now over 10 years ago. This was back in 2007 following the Virginia Tech shooting. And he talked about, here again, how that human nature is the problem here, and it's getting worse. This is clip 6 from his 2007 program.
Human nature doesn't understand. Human nature is the problem. God says it's human nature that must be changed. That is the problem. It's not getting rid of some guns. And even if you did that, if everybody turned in, were told to turn in their guns, the bad guys wouldn't turn in theirs, would they? No, that's quite a dilemma when you think about it.
That's my father from his program back in 2007 following the Virginia Tech shooting. And, of course, we've had a number of shootings since that one, the most recent one last week in South Florida. Last night, CNN sponsored this town hall discussion, titling it that the students of Stoneman Douglas demand action. And this was nothing more than an advocacy event. This was not news. This was not reporting. This was CNN getting behind the youths of Florida. CNN in full advocacy mode. CNN had a big headline most of the day yesterday about the walkout. Some students in Florida schools walking out in protest because something has to be done, they say. There has to be another law enacted or put in place, more legislation to fix these problems, to stop the shootings. And young people keep telling us this is the last time that's going to happen. Who really believes that? This is not the last time, sadly. But going back to CNN, they're not even concealing their bias anymore. It's CNN on board with the radical left. CNN tweeted out earlier this week, too, the 71 Florida lawmakers, the Republicans, who wouldn't vote for an assault weapons ban. And CNN wanted people to know who didn't vote for it and what their NRA rating was, because, you see, the problem is the NRA. The NRA and Republicans, they're hated more than the actual killers. They're hated more. You're going to hear some shocking clips here in just a second from this so-called town hall meeting. It was more like a pep rally for a confiscation of guns. The Daily Caller had a piece. I guess I won't read through a fair bit of it, but it's an 18-year-old that goes to one of these, well, not one of these schools, goes to that actual school where the shooting took place last week, and he's saying how the media is just politicizing this deadly event, this tragedy. They're using teenagers to further their message about gun control. At this town hall meeting last night, there was a 17-year-old, and to their credit, there were some Republicans that showed up. There was a gal, Dana Lash, who was speaking on behalf of the NRA. Marco Rubio, the senator, he was there in the discussion, part of the discussion, and basically just shouted down and booed most of the evening. But here's a 17-year-old speaking to a U.S. senator. This is from the CNN town hall meeting last night in Florida, clip one.
Senator Rubio, it's hard to look at you and not look down the barrel of an AR-15 and not look at Nicholas Cruz.
So here is a 17-year-old who is equating Senator Marco Rubio to Nicholas Cruz, the killer, the monster who killed 17 people at Parkland last week. Here's a 17-year-old saying that when I see you, I see an AR-15. The gun is the problem. The Republican is the problem. The NRA is the problem. That's what comes out of these kinds of back and forth debates. Just a lot of arguing, a lot of human reasoning. It's like I said yesterday, lots of ideas, lots of this, lots of that, but no solutions. And we just see crime and violence escalating. Whether they involve guns or not, the hatred, the division. It's an evil world. It's a dangerous world. And what are you left with in a dangerous world like this? If you're not looking to God for protection, if you're not looking to God for safety, what are you left with? Well, a lot of people conclude all that we're left with are our weapons, our guns. How far do you suppose the U.S. military would get? How far do you suppose our 18-year-old soldiers would get in Afghanistan or in Iraq or Syria or wherever? If they showed up without their weapons, if they showed up without their guns. Ann Coulter had a piece, probably the best one, on this ongoing debate, this never-ending debate. And, of course, the media there, as it always does, just pouring fuel on a fire, a raging inferno. Ann Coulter said, as fun as it is to ridicule the FBI for devoting massive resources to chasing down Hillary Clinton's Oppo research while blowing off repeated specific warnings about school shooter Nicholas Cruz, we've put a lot on the agency's plate. She does acknowledge that the FBI has a lot to keep track of. Like what? What could she be talking about? We're hauling in nearly 2 million manifestly unvetted third world immigrants every year, leading to a slew of FBI watch lists with a million names apiece. I mean, you can see why these people are falling through the cracks. You can see why they investigated the shooter at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando and then said, let's move on, no danger here. Or the Tsarnaev brothers up in Boston. Or Nicholas Cruz. I mean, they have millions of people on these watch lists because millions of people are flooding into the United States, totally unvetted. She says in 2015, then Director James Comey said that there were ISIS investigations in all 50 states, including Idaho and Alaska. That's just ISIS. Maybe the FBI brass would still be a bunch of incompetent PC nincompoops, she says, if we weren't dumping millions of psychotic and terrorist foreigners on the country. But even the most efficient organization would have trouble keeping track of the Nicholas Cruises when our immigration policies require approximately one-third of the country to be constantly watching another third of the country. I mean, there's just danger all over the place. Wide open borders. Anyone and everyone can come in. But don't you let law-abiding citizens purchase a handgun That's the thinking on the radical left. All these shootings, they happen in gun-free zones, have you noticed? And so many of them are happening in areas where, well, compared to other areas of the country, there's not nearly as many guns. Connecticut, for example, the Sandy Hook, I mean, it's not exactly known as a hotbed for firearms. Then you have South Florida. You have the Columbine shooting years ago in Colorado. So-called gun-free zones. Ann Coulter says there have been about 34 mass shootings since 2000. 47%, 16, were committed by first and second generation immigrants, i.e. people who never would have been here but for Teddy Kennedy's 1965 Immigration Act. These are some dramatic changes that have happened inside the United States over the past two generations or so. Now, this is not the only problem, but she brings up a good point. The FBI does have a lot to keep track of, and even if it is wasting a lot of time on this investigation or that investigation or a lot of resources, how do you keep tabs on a problem like this? Coulter says, and the immigrant mass shootings have been some of the most spectacular ones, such as Fort Hood and San Bernardino, two of the deadliest mass shootings in U.S. history at Virginia Tech in 2007 and the Pulse nightclub in 2016 were committed by first and second generation immigrants. She says, excluded from both lists, the Las Vegas shooting because law enforcement has released nothing but lies about it. So many lies. Why? What are they hiding? What are they concealing? Where was the town hall meeting following the Vegas shooting? Or what about the ones during the Obama administration? Now it's front and center. Now something has to be done about it. And now the country has to get behind the children who are up there saying, Senator Rubio, when I look at you, I see an AR-15. I see this killer, Nicholas Cruz. Do you think that's going to solve this problem? You go right down the list. As she says, half the mass shootings, Omar Mateen, Syed Rizwan Farouk, Tashin Malik, Christopher Harper Mercer, all of these first or second generation immigrants, Kuwaiti immigrant Mohammed Yusuf Abdulaziz. These are the ones guilty of mass shootings in the United States over the past 15, 20 years. Malaysian immigrant Elliot Roger, John Zawahiri, Cuban immigrant Pedro Alberto Vargas. I'm not even going through all the people that they killed or the numbers. Mexican immigrant Eduardo Cencion, shooting in 2011, killing four people. And then, of course, Nidal Hassan, the Fort Hood killer. Vietnamese immigrant Jiverly Wong shot up the American Civic Association in New York. Bosnian immigrant, South Korean immigrant. And on it goes. Ann Coulter says, first and second generation immigrants have committed more than 40% of all mass shootings since 2000. I know we've been admitting third world immigrants at a breakneck pace, but I don't think immigrants make up nearly half the population yet. Once we exclude the immigrant mass shooters, a clearer pattern emerges. The typical American perpetrator is a young man with paranoid schizophrenia, or, as we're now euphemistically calling it, autism, probably exacerbated by pot, a deadly combo platter. She says an immigration moratorium and widespread deportations would not only cut mass shootings in half, but it would also free up the FBI's time to focus on these delusional young men with the terrifying stare who hear voices no one else hears, young men like Nicholas Cruz. So, to give you a bit from the other side that's not included at the big town hall gathering last night, except to put someone on stage to laugh at and to ridicule and to mock, to get a little bit of feedback from the other side. If they're looking at an FBI that gets a tip a month before the shooting, and the FBI drops the case, the FBI doesn't pursue it, you can see a lot of people saying, well, we better get our own guns then. This is a dangerous world. And if you're not looking to God for help and protection in time of need, what else do you have, many Americans think, except for a firearm? Let me give you one more statement from this 17-year-old student last night. This is clip two.
So, Senator Rubio, can you tell me right now that you will not accept a single donation from the NRA in the future?
There you go. Big cheers at the pep rally. No more donations from the NRA. Which is, I mean, it's just like a drop in the bucket as far as donations go. And you look at donations coming from other radical groups that support late-term abortion, for example. It's corruption through and through. And yet, in this case, there's more hatred for the NRA, who are proponents of responsible gun ownership. But the NRA, the Republicans, and of course the gun itself, more hatred for that than there is for the hatred that's behind these killings. I gave a lecture this morning in Principles of Living. It's based on the opening paragraphs in Chapter 10 of The Missing Dimension in Sex, where Herbert Armstrong talks about the dignity of man. People speak of the dignity of man, he said. He wrote this many, many years ago. But how little do they know, usually, whereof they speak? As humanity generally conducts itself, little of that dignity is apparent. I mean, you hear people talking about the dignity of man or these precious lives that were lost last week. Or if you look at abortion, millions of lives that are lost. And lost, of course, is sugarcoating it. Murdered. Snuffed out. And yet we talk about these precious 17 lives. But look at the way we're conducting ourselves. It says in that same chapter, Mr. Armstrong just goes back and gives a broad, sweeping overview of some of the content that he has in the early chapters of The Missing Dimension. But he says here, yes, Jesus Christ, the firstborn among many brethren, is now on the very throne that governs the entire universe. He now controls every power, every force, every energy that exists. And he has merely pioneered the way. We, he says, if we yield to God and his government, may, through Christ, be reconciled to the great God and become co-heirs with Christ to inherit, after our resurrection, everything he already has inherited. And that is the true potential dignity of man. Mr. Armstrong says here, truly, most men who prate around in their vanity about the dignity of man little comprehend the real meaning of those words. That's really all that we're seeing in this debate, is people prating around in their own vanity, talking about the dignity of man, but not really understanding the meaning of those very words. Or in the case of of the Second Amendment, not understanding even the meaning of the U.S. Constitution, America's own history. This town hall meeting, by the way, there was a Florida teacher. Again, she teaches at this school where the mass shooting happened. And listen to her now as she asks her question. I believe this might have been aimed at Dana Lash, the one that was there representing the NRA. But here's clip three.
Now, here's my question. I'm a history teacher. I ask my students to define terms for me. So I'd like you to define something for me, because I've wondered about it, and I want to know, what is your definition of a well-regulated militia, as stated in the Second Amendment, and using supporting detail, explain to me how... Let me finish. And using supporting detail, explain to me how an 18-year-old with a military rifle is well regulated. And the world, our country, our nation is going to grade your answer.
That's a history teacher who's asking. I didn't play the answer for you. I think the lady gave a fairly good answer, even in the face of all the booing and such. But here's a history teacher calling into question the soundness of the Second Amendment. I mean, it's second. It's the second one the founders put in place, right after the free speech, and then the right to bear arms. My father in the America Under Attack booklet, he talked about how intensely the radical left wants to ban the Second Amendment, basically, to do away with it, to ban guns, to confiscate guns. And as he brought out in that clip I played earlier, of course, the criminals are the ones that would never give them up. Listen to what my father wrote. He says, the Second Amendment in the U.S. protects the people's right to bear arms, but for what? If you listen to the left, you would never know. To hear them talk about it, its purpose is so Americans can go out and shoot deer. That isn't the reason for the Second Amendment at all. The main point was to protect the citizens from government tyranny. The government might decide to take over. And if you don't have guns or something to defend yourself, what are you going to do? Unless you have God's protection, he has in parentheses. But a history teacher should well know this. And as my father asks in America Under Attack, why won't the radical left even mention this history? Why the founding fathers drew it up the way that they did? He says that the radical left will respond to this history by saying, oh, well, come on, that could never happen. The government could never become so corrupt that it turns into a tyranny. Really? What does the law of history teach us? Government tyranny is routine in human history, my father said. It's routine. It happens all over the place. And as he brought out in the booklet, our forefathers were not stupid. They were trying to preserve freedom. They wanted us to enjoy the freedom that we've enjoyed and taken for granted for so long now. Do you remember? Do our young people remember? Do those 17-year-olds at that rally, do they understand what it took, what sacrifices it took to obtain the freedoms that we take for granted today? My father says, I wonder how many Americans even know that the Constitution is the supreme law of the land. He said it's similar to how the Ten Commandments is the supreme law of God's church and the foundation of the entire Bible. But how many, you see, how many even know about this history? Well, we're running out of time here. I wanted to squeeze in some other things as well, but Sarah Palin was responding yesterday to Billy Graham's death and talking about, again, root causes, and she got as close as at least anyone I've heard over the past week to what the real problem is here. Here's what she said on Fox News, clip four.
Going back to what Billy Graham and hit the significance even of his passing on a day like this means is that reminder that nothing is going to change. Nothing is going to get better regardless of more laws being passed, more politicians' rhetoric spewed across our nation or not. Nothing is going to get better until we all realize that we are created for a purpose by God. All life is valuable from the beginning until the end of life. All life is valuable. And unless we give our lives back to God individually and collectively as a nation, nothing is going to get better.
That's Sarah Palin on Fox News yesterday making really a similar point to what my father made in 2007. Following the Virginia Tech shooting. I mean, this is the root cause. Those same founders who established the Second Amendment as the law of the land, those same founders also knew that freedom would not be preserved unless the American people held fast to religion and morality. And there's all kinds that we've gone through them before. Quote after quote after quote from the founders saying, if you're going to hold on to these precious freedoms, you better be a religious and moral people. You better be, as de Tocqueville wrote, you better be a good people. That's the key to your greatness. That's the key to your strength. Notice what my father had to say on that 2007 program. This is clip five.
Well, let's change the gun laws and get into all of that. And is that going to really solve the problem? Is that what God wants us to change? Is that getting to the cause of the problem? No, it isn't. That's just the dealing with the effect. What is the cause of this problem? What is the cause? If we don't get to the cause, then we're not educated in this book. That's what true education gets to, is cause and effect. What is the cause of all of these terrible problems? Now, if history...
That's my father from 2007. And again, go back to the show we put together yesterday. It's at thetrumpet.com. You look at human nature. You look at the God of this world. These are the causes and the solution, the causes of all the evil. And the solution is to get back to God's law. To get back to God's law. That's the only way out. Gun control is not going to solve the problem. Banning guns is not going to solve the problem. But if you're interested in real solutions, lasting solutions, well, we've got to turn back to the Bible. When we come back, we'll, speaking of the Bible, we'll look at this sensational discovery, the latest from Dr. Eilat Mazar in Jerusalem. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Don't forget to visit our website at thetrumpet.com. Every day, thetrumpet.com will help you understand your world by analyzing today's headlines under the clear light of Bible prophecy. Log on to thetrumpet.com and sign up for our daily Trumpet Brief email and subscribe to the Trumpet Magazine.
The Trumpet Daily.
So what are people excited about with this bowler? What do you think? Why do you think your phone's ringing off the hook?
Look, the chances, good chances, that we do speak about the sealing impression of the prophet Isaiah.
Right.
It's not like we can say it is not. The same way we cannot say that it is, even more, we can say that it is than that it is not.
Yeah.
So difficulties are there, and people are very much involved. They are eager to study.
Right.
How close we can get into the biblical reality.
Yeah.
And this is what archaeology is all about.
Yeah.
How can we make things as tangible as possible in light of the biblical stories?
Yeah.
And effects and yeah. narratives. This is a busy place, as you can hear right. in the background.
Yeah.
It's never quiet here. So never mind that. In the center of Jerusalem,
yeah.
The ancient Jerusalem, you know, between the Temple Mount on the north and the city of David on the south,
yeah.
we are excavating the royal quarter that King Solomon built,
yeah.
and it existed and continued to be used until the very end of the first temple period, until the Babylonian destruction.
Yeah.
So they love archaeology for good reason.
Yeah.
And we work very hard in order to reveal a very scientific, precise, methodological archaeology.
That's a little snippet from Brad McDonald's interview with Dr. Alat Mazar earlier today. I think that video is already at the trumpet.com website, as well as another video. We're going to play the audio for the world premiere video that we posted early this morning. Here at the end of the show, and you'll get to hear all 11 or 12 minutes of that to conclude today's program with. But just a few comments here before we move into that about this very special relationship. There is a connection between Isaiah and Hezekiah in the Old Testament. And so to find these two bulle, Hezekiah from a couple of years ago, right near this Isaiah bulle, and both in this royal quarter, this Solomonic structure on the Ophel. It's remarkable, the history that's been brought to life. I mean, when you think about what the Bible says about, in the case of the king, King Hezekiah, it says in 2 Kings 18 and verse 5 that Hezekiah trusted in the Lord God of Israel, so that after him was none like him among all the kings of Judah, nor any that were before him. That's how great this king was. This king who came to power as a 25-year-old young man. This king who ruled for 29 years. And he didn't accomplish all that he did single-handedly, as Brad McDonald writes in his piece that's at thetrumpet.com today as well. He writes, "The biblical books of Kings, Chronicles, and Isaiah show that the key to Hezekiah's success was his extraordinary relationship with Isaiah the prophet. Isaiah was as much the protagonist in Hezekiah's story as the king himself. And the remarkable renaissance the kingdom of Judah enjoyed during the 8th century was a direct result of this special king-prophet alliance." What a special, special history. What a special relationship this is. What glorious history God is resurrecting time and again. I mean, when Judah ran into trouble, Hezekiah went looking for Isaiah the prophet and said, "What do I need to do here? What's God's position on this?" Read it. Read it for yourself in Isaiah 37. Or the same stories recounted in 2 Kings 19. The Assyrians barreling down on Jerusalem, conquering all of these cities in Judah, pushing right up to the boundaries of Jerusalem. And Hezekiah crying out to God. There's cases in the Bible where Hezekiah and Isaiah prayed together. There's 15 verses in the Bible where they're mentioned together in the same breath, as Dr. Mazar says. Hezekiah and Isaiah, what a special king-prophet alliance this was. Well, these Assyrian armies were cutting a path through Judah. And so Hezekiah, his servants, went to Isaiah and said, "What do we do here?" And Isaiah said, "Look, don't worry about it. God will protect you. God will look after you." And meanwhile, the Assyrians Sennacherib's assistants were sending all, they were breathing threats against Hezekiah. Don't you trust in God for safety. You better not rely on your God. He's not going to deliver you. Well, Hezekiah heeded Isaiah's counsel, and he went and cried out to God. He talked about God's greatness. You can see this prayer, as I say, in Isaiah 37. He said to God, "Incline your ear, O Lord, and hear. Open your eyes, O Lord, and see. And hear all the words of Sennacherib, which has sent to reproach the living God. Of a truth, Lord, the kings of Assyria have laid waste all the nations and their countries." So here he was crying out to God for a last-minute intervention. It was awfully bleak at this time in Judah's history. Verse 19, this is in Isaiah 37, "And have cast their gods into the fire, for they were no gods, but the work of men's hands, wood and stone. Therefore they have destroyed them. Now therefore, O Lord our God, save us from his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you are the eternal, even you only." This is for you to sort out. This is for you to deliver us. As Herbert Armstrong wrote back in 1980, the vast armies of Assyria were marching westward and southward to invade Judah. The Jews were greatly outnumbered. They had no army or power to stand up against such a powerful foe. They were helpless. They faced certain defeat. Just as you may feel helpless in the face of your troubles today, he said that experience was written into the very Word of God for your learning and to show you the way today. This is the way to safety, to protection, to prosperity, to blessings and abundance. Going back to what I discussed in the first segment, this is the only way out of all of these difficulties and troubles that we're in. Only God can deliver us. As I say, so much to take away from this very, very special king-prophet alliance, to use the language Brad McDonald did. Make sure you read his article today at thetrumpet.com. "Has Elot Mazar Discovered Archaeological Evidence of Isaiah the Prophet?" And then also the world premiere video that's at thetrumpet.com today as well. You can view that and read these articles at our website, thetrumpet.com. When we come back, we'll be playing you the audio from that video that we released to the world just today. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Is there a more urgent expression in the Bible than the last hour? When he wrote his epistles, the Apostle John thought it was the last hour before Christ's second coming. In fact, it was only a type of our time today. Every detail of what John prophesied is now being fulfilled. Request the last hour. Never before has proper time management been more important, and this book will give you the urgency you need to organize your life God's way. Request The Last Hour. As part of this free offer, request The 7 Laws of Success by Herbert W. Armstrong, one of his most popular books ever. If you want to be a successful life organizer, then you need to read The 7 Laws of Success by Herbert W. Armstrong. Again, both books are completely free, so contact us now and get the help you need to organize your life God's way. The Trumpet Daily.
In December 2015, Jerusalem archaeologist Elot Mazar announced the discovery of an ancient clay seal, or bulla, The bulla contained an astonishing inscription. It read, "Belonging to Hezekiah, son of Ahaz, king of Judah." This tiny artifact carried a sensational message. This seal proved the existence of one of ancient Judah's greatest kings and proved the accuracy of the biblical record. Dr. Mazar didn't know it at the time, but another bulla bearing an intriguing inscription was waiting to be placed under her microscope. The Old Testament record shows that King Hezekiah was a contemporary of Isaiah the prophet. The biblical books of Kings, Chronicles, and Isaiah show that this prophet played a central role in Hezekiah's remarkable reign over Judah. Today we have indisputable scientific evidence proving the existence of King Hezekiah. But what about Hezekiah's chief counselor and one of the Bible's greatest prophets? Is there archaeological evidence proving the existence of the prophet Isaiah?
Now, the bulla of King Hezekiah was part of an assemblage. It didn't come by itself. First, we published King Hezekiah's bulla. That was the first thing. But then we studied the whole assemblage. And the whole assemblage contains more than 30 bullae. And one of them attracted our special attention. We were very skeptic at the very beginning. We didn't jump on the idea. It says LeYeshayahu. Okay, fine. This is quite a common name. And then it says Nun Bet Yud Navi, which is in Hebrew, if you just listen to it, to that, Navi, it's a prophet. So, wow, LeYeshayahu the prophet. This is... And then you have something nearby, which is Hezekiah, the King Hezekiah, near the prophet Yeshayahu. Fantastic. But then we needed to study very carefully.
The Isaiah bulla was uncovered in 2009 during a small archaeological excavation on the Ophel. The Ophel area is located adjacent south of the Temple Mount and has furnished numerous important artifacts since it first began to be excavated in 1968. The Isaiah bulla was discovered in an area adjacent to what archaeological evidence suggests was a royal bakery from the First Temple period.
The debris that we were excavating is just below us. So where King Hezekiah bulla was found, just below here, where Brent is standing, and then the whole assemblage was spreading all over. So we first published this one and then worked on the other bulla just as well as on figurines and other important items. And just on the other side of this, the same assemblage, just on the other side of that Herodian wall that was disturbing that assemblage in its middle, that we found another bulla that is of Isaiah.
The bulla is small and can be divided into three zones or lines. The challenge when studying the Isaiah seal is that part of the bulla is missing and part is damaged. The damage was caused by a finger pressing against the soft clay when the seal was first created almost 2,700 years ago. You can still see the fingerprints. The fact that part of the seal is missing does not affect its interpretation. This is because the missing section is inscribed with an image or motif and not text. Dr. Mazar believes it was the image of a grazing doe, symbolizing prosperity. The text on the second line reads, Yeshayahu. Although one letter is missing, there is only one viable option for the identity of the missing letter. It can only be the Hebrew letter Vav. So the text on the second line is indisputable. It reads, Yeshayahu. This is the Hebrew word for Isaiah. But is this Isaiah the prophet? The text on the third line is incomplete due to the damage sustained to the bulla's left side. Three letters can be deciphered, however, and together they read, Navi.
Archaeologist Reut Ben Aryeh has studied the bulla and explains why the missing letter is most likely an aleph, making the second word Navi, or prophet.
Among all the bullae from the excavation in the Ophel, we found this one. In its middle field, there was the name Yeshaya. So it was very exciting to read in its lower field the letters Nun, Bet, Yud, which suggest the word Navi, prophet. But there were two problems with this suggestion. First, the word Navi is usually written with the letter Aleph in the end. Second, most of the time in Biblical Hebrew, titles after private names appear with a definite article, the, and we don't have that in our bulla. So it was more reasonable to say that it is a private name, Novi or Novai, that is known from the Bible and also from epigraphic findings. But by examining the bulla, I noticed that the borderline is seen only on its right edge and not on the left edge, which means the impression is not complete. If we continue the borderline, we can see that there is a space for two more letters in the middle register and for one letter in the lower one. Usually, there is no empty space in the seal, so it makes sense to insert the letters Vav, He, and Aleph, and to suggest that this bulla was impressed by the seal of Yeshayahu Hanavi, Isaiah the prophet.
While the presence of an Aleph is possible and even likely, there are other interpretations. Professor Shmuel Achituv is an expert epigraphist and suggests Navi could refer to a place or surname.
It belonged to Isaiah, but that's all. Because it says Navi, Nun Bet Yod, which means Navi, but it lacks the Aleph. Perhaps Navi is to be pronounced Novi, Novai, or something else. Then that's a citizen or town of Nov. But of course, it can't be Navi, prophet. As I said, the lack of the Aleph. When we in modern Hebrew, maybe pronounce the name Navi, you don't feel, you don't hear the Aleph, but it was felt, it was pronounced.
Although there are other explanations, the weight of evidence strongly indicates that this is the seal impression of Isaiah the prophet. Consider, first, it is indisputable that this seal is inscribed with the Hebrew name for Isaiah. While this name was undoubtedly common in ancient Judah, it is rare for an individual to have his own private seal. Only important officials or royalty bore their own private seal, so whoever this Isaiah was, he was important. Second, the position of the text in relation to the outer edge of the bulla suggests that there is space in which added lettering would almost certainly have existed. Third, consider, too, that there are only three potential options for the identity of the missing letter in Navi. The most logical and the most natural explanation is that it was an Aleph. With an Aleph, the word Navi means prophet. Fourth, and most importantly, consider the archaeological context in which this bulla was uncovered. The Isaiah bulla was uncovered at the same time as the Hezekiah bulla, in the same location, in the same assemblage, and in exactly the same strata of soil.
What are the chances that we have just the name of somebody, Yeshayahu, and his family name is Navi? It can be, but it's kind of imaginary. Really? These two bulla of these two people that were so closely together described in the Bible are found in the same layer, just 1 meter at a distance from each other. The same context, the same layer. So it strikes very clearly that we're talking about the same two people. And to think it is not this person, it's another Yeshayahu. And his name is Navi, which is a prophet in Hebrew. Okay, missing the Aleph still. It can be there. And his name is Navi. The family name is Navi. It's a... not only imaginary, kind of. It seems like it can't be.
Consider what the biblical record says about the relationship between King Hezekiah and the prophet Isaiah. 2 Kings 18 and verse 5 says that Hezekiah was Judah's greatest king, second only to King David. But the books of Kings, Chronicles, and Isaiah also reveal that the key to King Hezekiah's success was his remarkable relationship with the prophet Isaiah. There are 15 occasions in the Bible where the names Hezekiah and Isaiah are mentioned in the same verse. Whenever King Hezekiah faced a crisis or needed counsel, he turned to the prophet Isaiah. And the prophet, inspired by God, guided King Hezekiah and all of Judah through the crisis. This was one of the most remarkable king-prophet relationships in the Bible. When you consider this seal impression in the context of biblical history, how likely is it that a seal impression discovered within a few feet of the Hezekiah bulla and inscribed with the name Isaiah belonged to a man other than Isaiah, the prophet?
The Trumpet Daily.